You're listening to the Equitopia podcast, helping horses and humans live in harmony. I'm your host, Kaylee Hansen, and today our guest is Callie King. Callie King is the founder of Horse Class and loves connecting people and ideas. She believes the connection and relationship we have with our horse is what matters most. She takes a holistic, science-based approach, considering the health and soundness of the horse, the suitability of saddle and tack, and the individuality of each horse and rider. Callie creates a positive learning environment for students and horses, making learning fun and incorporating the newest information and research on psychology, behavior, and learning.
So I was definitely one of those kids that growing up loved all animals, including horses, and was very lucky that my parents got me riding lessons starting when I was six. But to be truthful, I actually used to dread my first riding lessons because I found them so boring. I wanted to hang out with the horses. I loved the lessons where the instructor would put me on a lunge line and then I would get to like do crazy things with my hands and take my feet out of the stirrups. But when I just had to ride around, I thought it was super boring. And I got my first horse, who was given to me by an old rancher out in Colorado where we were living. And he was a quarter horse gelding, Scotch. He was 32 at the time that he was given to me. And it was a useful gift for both because Scotch was perfect for my 9-year-old self. And he also had kind of outlived his years as a working ranch horse. So it was also a gift that was one less mouth to feed on the ranch for his owner. So my time with Scotch really was ignited my love of exploring with horses and the connection with a horse. And I was always trying to see like what new places could we go and what new things could we figure out how to do together. With Scotch and actually with all of my animals, my dogs, my pet goats, my pet guinea pigs. I was always interested in that communication element.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of people can relate to that if you had the opportunity to just have a horse that you can go explore with. I know when I was a kid, I would just love riding out in the fields and using your imagination, whereas riding lessons themselves can be a bit boring just going in circles.
Yes. Yeah. And just seeing all the new things. And especially as a kid, there's that sense of freedom of being on a horse and being able to, go further and faster than you could on your own 2 feet.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. When did you become a professional?
By the time I was 15, I was coaching other riders at some kid camps. And even before then, I was 13 or 14 when I began starting ponies for some local breeders. But it was really when I graduated from college that I actually opened my barn as a riding school, as a boarding facility, started doing training and really did it truly professionally. But I had been, working with teaching kids younger than me since the time I was early teens.
Okay. Yeah. And then so I see you've authored one book, or do you have more than that?
I have a few books. They're all self-published. So under my company, Horse Class, we do online education for riders through courses and through books. And oftentimes there's an overlap. So the books that I've written are kind of complementary to our online curriculum and our online programs.
Oh, cool. And do you want to talk a little bit about those and kind of your approach to training?
Sure. I would say my approach, what I always say is that I don't teach a method. I don't have a Callie's method. What I strive to do is always to learn as much as I can about the best practices. Understanding behavioral science, understanding learning for horses and for people, and then teaching the principles of that behavioral science in a way that people can understand and apply no matter what discipline they're riding or no matter what what method they might be following, because to me, when we understand the principles that underlie behavior, then we can look at any method and we can not only see why it's effective or why it's ineffective, but we can also, you know, really have, well, I like to say I really enjoy empowering people to find what works best for them and their horse. So of course I teach a lot of techniques as well, but the principles of riding and of training and of behavior is really what I strive to give people first.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because then it empowers people to make decisions. I feel like that's really common now, where people just kind of do things because it's what their trainer said, and then they don't have the tools to make good decisions for themselves or, you know, how to advance their horse's training.
Yeah, and I think for a lot of people, a lot of my students that I've talked to, they've had this sense of like something didn't feel right. You know, what their trainer or their instructor was telling them to do, whether it was telling them to do as a riding instruction or something they were supposed to do with their horse, it didn't feel right to them. It didn't sit well, but yet they didn't have enough understanding to know why that was. And often then when they come in and they start going through our programs and within horse class, it's not just me. I teach some of the, kind of the entry level programs, and then we have many other professionals that go much deeper, whether it's in like biomechanics of riding or whether it's in training for four specific disciplines, training for show jumping, for example, or doing classical and handwork. But a lot of times when people come in and they hear the why behind either what they've been told to do or the why of what they've been told to do and why it doesn't make sense, it's just that light bulb moment of like, oh, now I can connect the dots. I can understand why this didn't feel right, and I have other options to go forward with.
So it sounds like your first experiences of not really liking the riding lessons, but really enjoying like the lunge work really influenced your teaching approach now.
It so influenced my teaching. Yes, it was, I mean, always when I teach, whenever I'm doing any, you know, work in person, I just strive to find the right balance of like, we're going to do fun exercises so that you can feel this concept in your body. You can actually feel where I'm describing, you know, your aligned leg position is, you know, what does it actually feel like to have your thigh on the saddle and to have your ankle underneath of your hip, for example. And then I also combine that with, and this is why it's important. And that's one of the things too, I think in the industry of riding instruction, especially for people that are maybe starting into horses or getting back into horses, if they're riding at barns where they feel like either they're one of few kind of newer adult riders, there's a lack of the why, which is the same thing we were talking about with a lack of the principles. And having that, especially as an adult learner, is really important. The mix of needing to, you know, be in your body and feel it, but then also having the concept of why you're doing that specific exercise.
So what were some of the experiences that caused you to go down that path? Or did you feel like it was a pretty steady journey for you?
I would say there's two experiences that really stand out. So one was really specific. I got to, I was working at a local barn. I was probably around 16 at the time, and I would go there early in the morning. I would clean stalls, you know, feed horses, do turnout. And it was in our area, it was a pretty successful hunter jumper barn. And I went there early one morning, and as I was like just starting the chores, it just really hit me of, I honestly feel like I am in some kind of asylum, because all of the horses, it was kind of that typical, the horses were in their stalls for, you know, 22 hours a day. They were, you know, ridden in ways where they were tense, and they, you know, were fed two meals a day, and they just, there's some horses were pacing their stalls, other horses were cribbing. And it was such a kind of a moment of, I'm going to do this better. I'm going to find a way to have a barn, to do this professionally, and to do it, to do it better, to give the horses a better life. And it was actually at the same facility too. I had another experience where clinic was being taught. And the way that some of the newer riders that had come in to participate in this clinic, the way that they were kind of talked about from the instructors was just, it was disrespectful, and it was really demoralizing of, you know, everyone's here to ride. We're all here to learn, and ultimately we're riding because we love this and we want to be having fun. But I felt that there was often a feeling towards especially newer riders or people that were riding for pleasure and, you know, weren't as competitively driven, that they somehow weren't as important at the barn and they were somehow lesser. And that was another thing that really motivated me of, I want to change this because to me, I'm here because I love horses, I love riding, and I want others to be able to have that same feeling and learn in an environment that feels really safe and supportive and where we feel like we're doing right by the horse.
I think it's really important for people to know that there are other ways of doing things. It seems like there's a lot of people that are at barns like that, that kind of tear them down instead of building them up. So that's one wonderful thing about the internet, is there's so much information that people can come across, whereas they wouldn't really have known before.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I also love about online, and it allows for so much community as well, because in the online space, we can connect with other like-minded people, even in, you know, from across the world, but that connection can still be formed. And then when we're doing things with our horses that maybe someone else at the barn is looking at it and being like, well, that's weird, why don't you just get on and ride and, you know, do what everyone else here is doing. It, when there's that online community, it provides that support of, you know, I am going to do things differently, I am going to try this new technique. And that can be just so important when you're kind of going against the grain.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely hard going against the grain because there's other people watching, and the online community just gives you that space to be in a more like learning and almost a play type mindset where it's okay to make mistakes, because when you're getting out of this linear training that maybe does not yield the best results overall, you just have to be in that open mindset.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Did you run into issues when you were trying to go for a more compassionate approach, or what are some of the challenges you ran into?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say the main challenge was probably the expectations within myself. So I initially had, I kind of measured my success as a trainer early on with if I could get the result. So if someone brought a horse to me for training and said, we want this horse to be able to be jumping around, you know, 2 foot in X amount of time, in a few months, if, you know, can you do it? And I would say, yeah, I think that's reasonable. And then I would start with the horse, and for whatever reason, I mean, we know that horses are so individual, and sometimes for physical, for emotional reasons for that horse, some progress really fast and some need to go at a completely different pace, just like us humans as learners. And in the beginning, I would get much more frustrated with myself and think that I had somehow failed if I wasn't able to either meet my own self-imposed or client-imposed timelines for working with a horse, or even if I came to the realization that, you know what, this horse isn't going to be a jumper. He doesn't enjoy it. He's not built well for it. And, you know, we've got another 2 years of work in good balance before we even think about coming back to going through these grids. Before, I used to feel like that I had somehow failed as a trainer, where, and that was probably the biggest challenge for me, is getting past my own mental blocks of, no, actually, to be the best trainer I can be, it means supporting that horse in whatever they need and in helping them go into what they will be best at. You know, sometimes people get horses and say, I want to jump, or I want to do dressage, or I want to trail ride this horse, and it might not just be a good fit for that horse. So I learned that having that compassionate approach for the horse and really putting the horse first truly meant putting the horse first, in front of deadlines, in front of you know, what someone had been hoping or expecting to do with that horse, maybe when they got them.
Did you find that people were receptive to that, or did you get pushback?
No, I would actually say people were really, really receptive. And that's why I said my own biggest block was probably myself in that, because I had my own expectations of, you know, what it meant to be, in quotes, successful as a trainer. Because when I learned how to teach people why I was doing what I was doing and why we needed to slow down with our horse and why, you know, maybe they really do need to find a different home for this horse to meet their goals, or, you know, we just had those really open conversations, people were super receptive to that message and to learning.
Were there any specific horses that just really challenged you, or could you talk about your experiences with them?
Yeah, there's definitely been a lot of challenges, because from the beginning when I started training, even before I started doing it truly professionally and, you know, had opened my barn, I was always really drawn to the so-called problem horses. I was always really interested in when there was a behavioral thing where, you know, where no one else could figure out why this horse was doing this, or no one else, you know, people were scared of the horse. I really enjoyed those. So I've had a lot of opportunities to work with challenging horses because of that. And one stands out that kind of highlights that he was part of that journey for myself that I just described. His name was Raleigh, and he was a big horse, probably a Percheron cross with something. We really don't know his history, because it was a client of mine that had bought him at auction and didn't know anything about him, but he was quite explosive, and it would be pretty unpredictable. It was generally related to his tack going on, you know, so like the saddle pad, the saddle, and I learned to recognize in him that there were signs. You know, it wasn't that he was just comfortable and then he would explode. Of course, he was just, he would really start to go into that shutdown mode, into that, you know, it's been called learned helplessness, or maybe a level of dissociation, where he would just kind of check out, and then suddenly he would come back in and then he would just explode. So it felt out of the blue, but you could really see it coming if you really watched and saw, is he still engaged or has he kind of gone blank here? But he was one that I worked with for a long time. He had actually come in for short-term training, and then I had the discussion with the owner of, you know, what he's going to be a very long-term project. This isn't something that I'm going to be able to really get results to meet your goals. She wanted to be riding him and showing him. So she ended up just giving him to me so I could work with him long-term. And he was one that the process of several years of working with him, doing a lot of different modalities, doing some body work, even doing some where a lot of the horses that I have come in for training, I do video surveillance on them if they have a problem behavior, because it can help to spot a physical issue that might be going on. And he was doing some things that were probably indicative of something neurological, you know, even when he was just alone in his stall. So he was one that I ended up, you know, saying, I just don't feel it's safe to ride him, that I can't get him there. And he was one that I struggled with at first, because at first I felt like, well, now I failed because I didn't find the solution to be able to ride this horse. But in reality, he was much more comfortable around people. He went from being a horse that would, you know, walk away and not want to even have people getting close, to coming up and, you know, being at the gate whenever people were walking by his field. We had a small therapy program that was operating out of my barn at the time. He was one of the most chosen horses for the therapy clients to be working with. And they were just doing, it was equine-assisted psychotherapy. So they were just spending time with the horse on the ground. But he was one that really challenged my belief of, this is the result I need to get in order to be successful. And we didn't end up riding Raleigh. He just continued to live that, do his therapy sessions, and, you know, kind of be a part of our farm in a different way.
I haven't heard of anyone having the video surveillance on the horses, but that makes a lot of sense. Did you plan on having the video surveillance so you could watch the horses, or did you kind of stumble upon the benefits of that?
No, I learned that from a course that I took with Dr. Sue McDonald of New Bolton Center, and she was teaching a class on, I forget the exact title, but it was basically behavior problems, how to tell if it's physical or psychological. And I had originally contacted Dr. McDonald and sent her some videos of horses that I was really stumped on that I was having behavior problems with, and they ended up being physical. So between seeing a few benefits of what I learned from Dr. McDonald in that class, we just made it standard practice for if a horse came in with a behavioral problem, the first thing that they would do within the first week of being at the farm is have at least an 8-hour surveillance video of them in their stall that we would review. And there were so many times that we then would pull clips from that video, send it to our veterinarian, and we were able to diagnose what some problems were. And you know how it is with a lot of behavior problems. You solve the physical and the problem goes away.
Yeah. Were your vets specially trained with those behaviors, or were they able to see it? Because I feel like so many behavior problems are physical, but sometimes it's harder for vets to see that or know what's really going on. So how do they diagnose that?
Yeah, well, the beauty of the videos is that we then had a place to start the diagnosis. So an example was one horse that was she came to me for the training problem of she's head tossing and we can't get her bridle on and she's super reactive, you know, when we're around her head. And it was being called she's head shy and she needs to be trained to not be head shy. And of course I thought, well, this definitely seems like there could be something physical. So when we did the surveillance video, we saw that she would often stand with her head kind of cocked to the side. She was consistently rubbing I think it was her left cheek, like she was consistently rubbing there. So it gave us something that then I not only could go to them to say, hey, it really is worth spending the money to do some diagnostics and do some radiographs here and have a vet come in. But then we also had that to show the vet of, hey, she's indicating more on this left side. You know, let's start with radiographs there. And she ended up having a broken tooth.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense too, being able to show the clients exactly what you're talking about, especially with the more subtle things. So
yes,
and so interesting.
And it's another thing I love about these videos is it depends on the horse, but you know, sometimes when we see a horse do something one time, maybe a funny stretch in the course of the hour that we're with them and we're lunging them or riding them, and we think, oh, that was a little strange, but then we don't really think about it past that. But there's been so many times in the video, so another specific example was a little thoroughbred mare, Promise, that was super reactive, also with tack, like ear pinning, wanting to bite, you know, the girthiness was called her problem. And she would do this little stretch with her neck, and it kind of looked like, okay, she's just stretching. But when we saw her in the video, and like consistently when she's standing, every 20 minutes she's doing the same stretch, then it was much more pinpointed of, okay, this isn't just her stretching because we started lunging. This is, there's obviously a problem somewhere, like, you know, base of the neck or the spine. So then that was another case. We took her in, we did some nerve blocks, radiographs, and found that she had had very severe kissing spine.
Oh, interesting. Do you have the video, is it in a stall or in a paddock?
I have done both. I typically do the stall just because it's so much easier to set up the video and to have the horse in frame the whole time, which is important. And it's like an 8-hour video. And then, you know, we watch it fast forward. And like I said, we always confer with the vets as soon as we see something unusual, because I don't have the experience to diagnose, but it just allows us to say, okay, let's start here for diagnosis.
Oh, interesting. Are there any other tools that you use that are less common, kind of like that?
No,
or maybe approaches?
think that's probably our main one. I mean, the only other thing that we did when I was taking horses in for training is I also enjoyed really documenting their progress. So I would have a monthly sheet that I would update, body condition score, top line score, tracking right and left. Like I had about 10 different factors that I was tracking, and then I would take photos with that. And it was just interesting also to be able to really track the horse's progress. But I think it wasn't even the tracking, it was the fact of it forced me to once a month, spend the 30 minutes with that horse to really look at them physically and palpate and, do all the things that we should be doing every ride. But it was like that focus time of I'm evaluating this horse. And there were so many times that I would even see little things or see changes like, oh, you know what, this horse actually has, dropped a little bit more weight and, we need to make a feeding change. Sometimes I think when we're around our horses day to day, those changes, if they're really subtle, can be harder to see.
Yeah, that's a really good idea of doing the monthly updates because it is so hard to see the small, subtle changes, but over even a month period, it can be really big. How did you get more into the behavior side? Did you take courses or books, or did you have a mentor that specialized in it?
So I've always been interested in the mind and always interested in psychology. From the time that I was in college, I didn't have enough credits to actually take any psych courses, and I wasn't in any kind of a psych major, but I would always go in and sit in on those courses because I just found them so fascinating. So I had kind of that interest even from when I was, again, super young and I had my first horses, or I used to have pet goats and I would train them to do obstacle courses and all this, and I would, experiment with, I did a lot of luring at that time with my goats. I would put like the corn, at the other side of this obstacle course, and then they would run through it, and just a lot of trial and error and having fun, really, as a kid. But then what really was an aha moment for me of I need to apply this to my horses was when I started, I got my first puppy that I was training, like, from a puppy on, and I started diving into reading a bunch of dog training books. And, the dog training world tends to be further ahead in terms of behavioral science applied to the training. So there, I was reading then about behavioral science applied to dog training, and I saw how excited my dog was every time that we went into a training session. And it was just one of those like moments of my horses are not this excited when I go to train. So then I started thinking, okay, I need to learn a lot more about how I apply this to my horses, because up until then I had studied under some traditional trainers, varying levels of how do I want to say it? Kindness to the horse, but and I had studied under some, natural horsemanship different programs, but it was that aha moment with my puppy that I said, okay, I need to learn a lot more about this applied to horses. So it was pretty much just my self-study. I still ended up finding that I read a lot more about training in other species and about psychology and people and was applying that. And then I started to find some mentors in the space that were actually talking about behavioral science with horses and studied with them in different ways.
Oh, cool. That makes a lot of sense. I do feel like horse training overall, it's changing now, but very kind of rigid and with the dominance theory. So do you use positive reinforcement?
Yeah, I do say that I use every quadrant, of the operant conditioning system, as well as the other components of learning theory. So I use positive reinforcement. I do use pressure. So I use negative reinforcement. To me, the more that I look, really look at behavioral, it's tough for me to put anything really cleanly in one box and say this is only a positive reinforcement technique or this is only a negative reinforcement, because to me they end up being very gray zones. What's kind of the difference between when we're adding pressure, does that, when is that a punishment versus just adding pressure to then release it and be in negative reinforcement, for example? Or even with positive reinforcement, you know, I was working with Mustangs a lot last year, and, you know, me walking over to their fence holding a target was quite a bit of pressure, even though I was intending to go and just do a reward-based training exercise. So that's why also I like to really try to understand the big picture and see what's happening instead of just saying that I do, you know, one form of training.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, especially with the Mustangs and how much pressure would be of just having a target and that presence and that strong intention.
Yeah. The intention is such a good thing. That's another big one I think that can be underestimated, is how much pressure can just be in intention, just in our presence and our expectation of, I want you to do this thing.
I'm curious, like, what your approach would be when you have a horse that comes in with a behavioral problem.
It varies so much. And this is too, you know, when I teach my online courses, I really strive to do this, teach principle based and teach a big toolbox, because that's what I've found most effective in my own training. So if they come in with a behavioral problem, if I have any suspect that it might be physical, we do the behavioral video and, you know, consult with vets as needed there. I typically like to spend just time with the horse and kind of getting to know them and just starting a little bit of relationship building that way. And that might just mean I kind of hang out in the field with them. We go for some walks, and then again, it so varies what the problem is. It's going to be totally different with every horse and whatever stage of training there are, etc.
Yeah, I love that you just spend time with the horse, because that's so important to them, and the relationship and the training. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure maybe it comes from pressure from clients, but also trainers themselves, that you feel like you have to be riding them every day or working on these very specific things. But the relationship is the foundation. The horse has to enjoy being around you.
Yes. Yeah, it is. You know, that old adage of slow is fast, I feel, is so true with horses, and it's so easy to forget, but it is true.
Yeah, most definitely. Do you have any other stories you want to share about horses that have had a profound impact on you?
See, there is another one. Her name was Marlene. Is Marlene. Mm-hmm. She was the first Mustang that I worked with when I went out to the Return to Freedom Sanctuary in Lompoc, California. Mm-hmm. And she had been to the point where she was wearing a halter and doing a little bit of leading, but she didn't like it. And basically that had been a trainer that was there a few months before. They had moved on. And since that time, she hadn't let anyone else even go up and touch her. So she was super standoffish, and I went in thinking, okay, I know how to do positive reinforcement. I know that that's never been done with her in the past. I think I'm going to be able to make a big difference really quick. And she started off with it. First, took a long time for her to even just want to eat out of my hand, which can be pretty typical with a lot of them. But we got up to that point. We got up to me touching her. We got up to even starting to get close to putting the halter on. But what I learned from Marlene was not only the time spent and going slow, but also needing to be super adaptable for the context that I was working in. So at the sanctuary, and when I was able to be there, I wasn't able to be there ideally to work with a really positive reinforcement only kind of based approach, because I didn't have control over feeding schedules. I wasn't able to be there. And I started noticing that if she was hungry, she was a lot more interactive in the training. And if I came after she'd had a big meal, she was kind of just like, I'd really rather not interact at all. Doesn't matter how good of food or hay or whatever you have. So with her, I realized, okay, she is interacting definitely for the food. We are slowly starting to build a relationship this way. But there was some time pressure with her because her feet were super overgrown. And I either needed to be able to get her to a point where I could safely trim her feet to take that pressure off, or they were going to have to sedate her or put her through the chute system. And, you know, either one of those processes would have been even more traumatic. So there was the time pressure there. And what I ended up doing was just saying, okay, I'm going to shift approaches a little bit, and I am going to consciously use a little more pressure, a little more negative reinforcement, just in my body presence with her. And when she moves off, not chasing her or anything like that, but just I'm going to move with her so that she doesn't, you know, get to just move off and then kind of end the session at her own choice. And it actually only took 2 days of doing that, of just she would move off and I would walk with her and we would walk around for 30 minutes and then she would stop, I would back off, and just kind of that that pressure and release of, you know, gradually getting closer, moving away, and having her become more and more relaxed with me there. And also know that I think it was twofold. It was, there was an element of relationship building in that time spent, but it also was an element of, since I didn't have control over feeding schedules to increase motivation for the food, there was also an element of, I'm going to stick with this because you really need to wear a halter. And she did end up getting where, you know, within another week or two after that, I had the halter on, we were picking up her feet, getting her feet trimmed. So that was a lesson for me of, I came in so confident that I was just going to use positive reinforcement and, you know, have her to where we were doing her feet really quickly and just be using the positive reinforcement. And it was another time that I realized, okay, I've got to look at the whole picture, which also includes the context of the environment that the horse is in and the time pressure that's sometimes presented by things like medical concerns.
I like the flexibility in that, of not being so rigid and this is the only way to do it, but what is best for this horse, and having their feet done is very important for them.
Yes, definitely.
And then I think we'll move on to some of these questions. And what are books that you recommend most to people, or books that have really greatly influenced you? And they don't have to necessarily be horse related.
So I have three. They are, two are pretty horse related. They're all three pretty horse related behavioral books. Mm-hmm. But it's one of the things I find that I do still read a lot of behavior books and a lot of psych books, and even the behavior books that are just about animals. I think it's one of the things that I love most about being a trainer is I learn so much about myself and about other people, and I can improve my person relationships from what I learn as a trainer and what I learn working with horses. Mm-hmm. So my all-time favorite training book is Don't Shoot the Dog by Karen Pryor. Mm-hmm. And then I also love How to Train a Fill-in-the-Blank by Dr. Patricia Barlow-Irick. And they're just good to me, like good primer training 101 books, but I still go back to them because they're just such good, clear examples and case studies of how to use, you know, tried and true training concepts. And then the last one, this is definitely not a fun, like sit down in the evening and read kind of book, but The Mind of the Horse by Michael LeBlanc. It's a review of many scientific studies of the sensory systems of the horse, of different training and learning. And my copy of that is just like earmarked and post-it notes and bookmarks everywhere, because I found it such a good reference for, especially if I'm having conversations with people and I want to just kind of myth bust a little bit. It's a great reference for that.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to check those out. And then, how has a new failure or parent failure set you up for success later? And do you have a favorite failure?
I actually think the story that I shared earlier of Raleigh is my favorite failure, because, you know, now I can look back and say it wasn't a failure. I feel that in my time with him, I was able to improve his quality of life and improve his interactions and his outlook, if you will, towards people. But at the time, it did feel like a failure for the reasons I shared of, I had an expectation of, oh, well, if I'm a good trainer, I should have been able to have him under saddle by now.
I think that is really what success should be, though, is that we improve the quality of the horse's life.
Yes.
So,
Yeah.
at the end of the day, that's what really matters.
Definitely.
What new belief, behavior, or habit has most improved your life?
There's so many I could share because I'm definitely a habit-based person. But one of the new habits that I'm doing is, so I'm always wanting to be a student. I'm always wanting to learn something new because I feel that it keeps, as a teacher as well, when I'm also a student, it keeps me really in touch with the feeling of being a student, with the feeling of being new, and with the experience of learning something as a beginner. So I'm constantly taking up new things. And what I'm doing at the moment is I have a little miniature dachshund, Frida. She's almost 10 years old now. And I've been learning to do scent work with her. So it's why I say this as a habit is I find that with something like this, I've made it a habit of 10 minutes a day. We go out and we do these little search and scent work exercises. And it's an example of for me doing something new, doing something that I find really interesting that is bonding with one of my best friends, which is little Frida. And yeah, and it's also definitely helping my training in general because it's a whole new training and the behavior and the learning processes are the same, but whenever it's like a new type of learner and I've never done, this kind of scent work before, so it's figuring out setting up the exercises and, watching Frida, really, really fun.
Yeah, that would be a really fun exercise. I and the dog would love it too. I feel like that's kind of what's missing in horses is doing things purely for the horse to enjoy.
Yes, yeah, and harnessing those instinctive behaviors. Frida as a dachshund, she is a little hound, so it's an outlet for her to kind of exercise, those strong instincts that she has.
Yeah, most definitely. What are bad recommendations that you hear in the horse industry?
I would say the two biggest ones, and I'm doing a within my company horse class, we're doing a little workshop right now in the three biggest myths, and these are two that I decided to talk about in depth because I feel that they are so common. The first one is how a lot of riders are taught in just that, heels down, pull your shoulders back, sit up. And it ends up in a really tight posture that is not effective, that is often not very comfortable, definitely not very secure for the rider, and is, in the long run, it's the horse that suffers because they have a rider that is unbalanced and then can't use their aids effectively, is going to be more heavy on the reins, etc. So I think that just kind of generic riding advice that is not well taught, not well explained how to interpret that kind of advice is a problem. And then I think also the dominance theory that is still really common in the horse world that, you've got to just show them who's boss is certainly detrimental because I find that people put too much emphasis on being a leader instead of just having good communication principles.
That makes sense. When you communicate clearly to the horse knows what to do and what to expect, and then they're able to relax and respond appropriately.
Yes.
Cool. All right. And if people want to learn more about you, where can they find you?
Go to horseclass.com and we have tons of free resources. I have been doing a video every Friday since 2012, so we literally have hundreds of videos on all kinds of topics, and we have an amazing collection of instructors as well.